Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast where we're Google developers talking to other Android developers about Android development. I'm working on a slogan for the podcast. How's it going so far? It's sort of a work in progress.
Yeah, work in progress.
I'm Chet Haas. I'm from the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm Tor Norby. I'm from the Android Tools team. And today we have as a guest...
I'm Rachel Garb.
That was your cue. We'll start this all over again, and then we'll give you like a visual cue. All right, let's try that again.
I'm Rachel Garb. Hi. I manage interaction design and user research for the Android OS team.
Awesome. What is interaction design?
Wow. It is figuring out the behavioral and structural aspects of a user experience. So flows, navigation, labeling, sequencing from one screen to the next, how things are organized.
So even the breakdown into screens is something that you would be working on?
Yeah, absolutely. We figure out all the things that a user will need to accomplish in an app and then figure out how to organize that all into different screens and then how those screens will navigate between each other.
So it's kind of the mental model. Do you come up with a mental model of like the entire flow through all of this stuff?
And yeah, I often call it an interaction model.
Okay. Not often, but not always.
It's a word that helps describe and encapsulate all that stuff I just mentioned.
Okay. Also, it doesn't discriminate against people who don't have a mental capacity.
That's right.
Capacity.
Yeah. People aren't always thinking when they're using your stuff.
In fact, most people aren't thinking most of the time, I think, based on my personal experience.
Is that like a special part of interaction design, dealing with things that people aren't thinking about? So we're sort of giving subconscious clues?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The word that you sometimes hear if you talk to somebody in my profession is affordance or scaffolding. These are words I try not to use because I think they're a little uppity, but they're cues, as you put it, that help the user, sort of intuitively without even thinking about it, know what to do next or what this is all about.
I heard a word yesterday. I think it was it from a designer? It was. The word was ideation, which gave me nauseation. it was just one of those, like, let's take a word that's working really, really well and then let's stick a different ending onto it because we needed something new for our slides. So I don't know if that's commonly used in your group.
That's a kind of word that I would probably keep within the group. Ideation often refers to the very, very beginning of a project when, you have your high level goal of what you need to do. We're building a product that will do X, and then you're exploring very wide all the possibilities, all the different approaches that you could take for design. And it could be the visual aspects of the design. They do a lot of ideation on their own, or interaction. The word I tend to use for that is explore.
I think what we call it is brainstormation,
Brainstorming, but maybe...
No, brainstormation.
Yeah. Yes. Perfect. So there's interaction design. There's other aspects of design and certainly other aspects of your overall design team that mm-hmm. we have interacted with on. Let's see if I can break it down. So we have interaction design, sort of the overall flow. What do you call it? The interaction flow? Interaction model.
Yeah, interaction model. Flow, okay. Structure.
Right. And then there's the assets themselves, the way those buttons are going to look, the background color.
The visual style,
So
color
visual
palettes, layout patterns, things like that.
Okay.
That's what we call visual design.
Okay. And then there's also motion design, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And that's the animations, how long are they going to run for, what they're going to look like. It seems like there's a lot of overlap between animation design and interaction design, right?
There is. I'd say there's more between visual and motion. And so in our organization, the visual and motion designers are grouped together. They sit together.
So it's visual design plus time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the fourth dimension. Yeah.
So, as a developer, we sit in IDEs all day. What is the sort of primary tool that you use as an interaction designer? Is it like...
VI?
is it a whiteboard? Or are there specific tools that you have for designing these interactions? Or does it depend on sort of which part of interactions that you're doing? And clearly visual design, you're probably going to be in some professional drawing tool. But what about overall interaction
design? I'd say on the interaction design side, we're less standardized on tools than on the visual design side, where it's important to be more standardized because they're delivering a family of assets that everybody needs to use in the same way. interaction design. So tools, like one tool that I have used a lot is OmniGraffle, which is a program that lets you easily create all sorts of charts. And it basically lets you draw shapes and text and, you know, arrows and lines and stuff, and just and put everything just where you want it. And it works really well. Visio, I guess, is the equivalent in the Microsoft world.
I've used OmniGraffle for presentations.
Yeah.
It does like a nice job with drop shadows too. You can export to PNG and then...
That's the main thing, is you want to make your designs pretty.
Yeah, so it's great for line drawings, which is sort of what I deal in most of the time. We call them wireframes. Other people on my team are using Adobe Illustrator a lot. I would say it's a more sophisticated version of OmniGraffle. And Illustrator is often what our visual designers use, so that works nicely there too.
So if you're going to design a screen, so would you then reach for OmniGraffle and draw a rectangle to represent the screen and then draw?
Yep.
So you don't have like pre-made little wireframes or whatever for standard Android components that you drop in. You really try to keep it sort of napkin style.
I tend to go napkin style, because if I start using pre-made templates and stuff, then I start getting caught up in a level of refinement that I don't, that I shouldn't be focusing on yet.
Because then people will say, hey, what about that font? It's 2 pixels larger than the other
one. Right. And then I start obsessing over it. And that's not what I need to be doing at that point. At that point, I need to be exploring different possibilities and quickly drawing them up. If I had better hand drawing skills, I might use a whiteboard or a notebook. And there are people on my team who do that. But for me, you know, I've just found that this digital tool works really well, and I'm quickest in it. So that's what I use.
So one of the things that I find interesting about what I know of your background is that you don't think of yourself as a designer. You didn't go to design school. Like, I would think of, you know, everybody in the UX department obviously has an MFA in, you know, whatever.
That's right.
And spent their entire youth dressed goth. and that's not what I've picked up from you, that you are, you know, clearly comfortable in the interaction design world, but you're not coming from an artist background.
That's right. Yeah, no, I don't think I have much artistic talent at all. My background actually was in writing. I studied technical writing, and my first job out of school, and by the time I left school or was starting to graduate, I had already figured out that user interface design was going to be a thing. It just wasn't really out there yet. There were no programs in it. I'm dating myself, I think. So I stuck with technical writing. And what happened was, I had an internship between, I think it was junior and senior year, and I needed to write a user manual for a piece of software. And it was so hard to explain everything because it was so poorly designed. And it was designed by the people that built it. There was no professional designer on it. There was no UI design. This profession just wasn't a common thing.
Yay, so, engineers.
Yeah, so I was just like, oh, it would be so much easier to explain if it were just designed a little differently. So I started speaking up and saying, hey, have you thought about this? And then realized, this is going to be a thing. And I can't get a degree in it yet, but I can start trying to make my way into it. And that's really what I did. So I was a technical writer for a few years. I got to know the people. My first job out of school was at IBM. They were one of the companies that actually did have people in this field. They called them human factors back in the day. And so I got to know my human factors department. I volunteered to write specs for them and get to know what they do by offering my services as a writer.
Interesting. So did you end up writing the manual for the UI that you wanted them to have? And it was completely fiction. Right. It read really well, and it taught the users very well how to use a program that didn't exist.
Well, you could turn it around to the engineer and say, here's the spec.
Yeah. Nice. Okay.
Yeah, no, that summer, I wasn't that ambitious in my internship. But eventually I made my way into it through writing. It seems to be, over the years, I've noticed more and more technical writers making their way into either user research or interaction design, because it's just more and more words, they matter so much in interaction design. I consider them a part of that.
And it makes a lot of sense to me that this is a different field really than visual design, right? So I would think that some of the core things you deal with would be like cognitive psychology, you know, dealing with how does a user understand this, not really what does it look like or what feeling does this picture give me, empathy give me from art. But this is really more about understanding, you know, the way people think about things and how to basically organize it in a way that they would understand.
That's right. It's a very eclectic field. You see people from all sorts of backgrounds. I've seen architects move into this field, cognitive scientists, as you mentioned. I've seen software engineers move into the field. it's one of those things where I don't know if it's common sense, but a lot of it is just, yeah, really being able to put yourself into the mindset of the people that you're designing for and figuring out what their motivations are and anticipating what kinds of problems they might have and tackling those before they actually become problems through good communication and clear sequencing of steps and helping people understand where they're at and what they're doing all the time.
So it's a bit like, I mean, I guess if you're going to extend the writing metaphor, you're telling a story or you're...
Yeah, an interactive story.
Right. Although if you want to be a mystery writer, you could also look at it as manipulating the user in the direction you want them to go.
We do have that power and we have a responsibility too. We have to be very careful. But yes, so, you know, I'm one of those people that never cared about tinkering. Like, you know, I don't care what's under the hood of my car. I just want it to go. I want to drive. And I think about that a lot when I'm designing. Does every detail about something need to be explained to the user? Or should I just tell them what they need to know so that they can do what they need to do? And but do I think about that small minority of people who do want to look under the hood and then provide an affordance or a way to for them to do that?
Interesting. So there's different aspects of writing because I really enjoy writing as well, different types. But I think whenever I get into technical writing, I find joy in explaining those dark underbelly bits. Right. It's mm-hmm. like once you understand how the system works underneath. I find it useful to try to educate other people and say, well, this is what's going on there and this is what you need to understand in order mm-hmm. to get, you know, high performance applications or things to look good or whatever.
Yeah.
The ability to translate when it is super complicated and really tough for people to understand, then the ability to translate that into simple enough words mm-hmm. Is also something that's useful. But it sounds like you have sort of a different take, like you're not going to that level. You basically yeah. want to simplify the surface level. And mm-hmm. explain that very clearly.
Yeah, the audience that you are dealing with, I suppose, is mostly developers, yeah. right? So they have a certain level of understanding that the people that I deal with just will never have.
So, yeah, your stories are for users and ours mm-hmm. are not our user base.
Well, yeah, I do a lot of technical writing for a different audience as well as interaction designer, and that is for the engineers who are on my team who are implementing the things that we're creating. And for that, yes, then I will do what you're doing. And I love that part of the job. I love creating specs and breaking it all down and making sure that every little detail is documented and captured. Every nuance, every edge case. I have to think through all of that as an interaction designer.
So what kinds of things have you worked on since we talked about mm-hmm. users? I'm just kind of curious, like the kinds of users you deal with.
Yeah, on Android. I mean, the thing about Android is it's such a vast user base. And I work on the core parts of Android, so the stuff that you interact with that's not an app. A lot of those things, they should feel, if we're doing our job right, they should feel invisible.
So
you shouldn't even think
UI.
About them. Yeah, the system UI. Mm-hmm. Most recently, I worked on a redesign for Marshmallow on volume controls and Do Not Disturb.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a topic of passion for a lot of our listeners as
well.
Oh,
I know. I've
heard of that feature. Yes, we've taken a few runs at that.
Yeah.
So actually, do you want to talk about some of the details there, some of the
Absolutely.
Problems that need to be solved? Because that has been a tricky thing over the years, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Go.
Okay. Well, so in Lollipop, we recognized there were a ton of pain points. And Dave Burke, he talked about this on stage at Google I.O., right? Like we understood that we needed to do some things to fix it. And I think we did. And the way we did that was constraints. So in Lollipop, we set bigger constraints on ourselves, more constraints. It was like, well, we have to put the Do Not Disturb. Clearly, we have to put it in with the volume controls because these things are so interrelated. But what that ended up doing for us is it made it really challenging because the volume control suddenly went from this very simple, understandable, fundamental thing to having this new paradigm shift, which was the interruption filtering. So we lifted that constraint when we started working on Marshmallow, and that gave us more possibilities to explore for solutions because we, you know, when you put a constraint on something, it narrows down the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, all right, well, what are other possibilities we could do for surfacing entry points to Do Not Disturb? And we arrived at Quick Settings, which is an obvious good choice for it because it's a place that people already go to get to frequently needed global settings on their device.
Okay, so now, so you broke that functionality out of the volume button. The volume button went back to, you know, now it's easy to just toggle vibrate or
yes, that's true. However, when Do Not Disturb is on, it is important for users to understand the effect it has on volume. So what we do now is if Do Not Disturb is not on, then you just see a very simple volume control. But if it's on, we add a little footer at the bottom to remind you that Do Not Disturb is on. And if the volume stream that you're currently, that's currently in focus, is completely disabled because of Do Not Disturb, like it's just never going to make any sound, then we give it a disabled appearance, the cues that we were talking about earlier, to remind you that this is what's going on. Plus, we give you a way to just end Do Not Disturb right away.
So I would think maybe the way to take this further in a future release, I don't want to talk about, you know, the things that we may or may not have planned, but maybe a full-on graphic equalizer instead of just a single volume slider. I think that'd be really interesting to the audio people in the
audience. Well, oh, yeah, there is one more part to this new volume controls. So it used to be that we were trying to be really clever, like, oh, the user only really cares about the volume stream for the thing they're doing right now. So you could be, say, about to watch a YouTube video, and instead of showing you the media volume slider, we would show you the ringer.
The media hasn't started yet.
Because the media hasn't started yet.
You're trying frantically to turn the volume down
before
it starts,
right,
and it's not ready yet. Yeah.
But that really doesn't make any sense. So what we realized was, you know, it's up to the apps to do the best job possible of saying this is the right volume stream to show for this situation. But let's have a way that users can expand and then see all the volume controls. So we added that in Marshmallow 2.
Yay.
Okay.
Best feature ever.
I think I've run into that problem with the different types of media where an app would be in the background, but it still, for some reason, had control over the media volume of the overall device. So then I was trying to control the ringer volume and I could not.
Yes.
I couldn't get there without going into like advanced audio settings somewhere.
In fact, we did. We realized this was an issue in Lollipop. So in one of the follow-on Lollipop updates, we added a button just to get you from media to ringer volume controls. And then we fixed it completely in Marshmallow with the better solution.
Okay. Completely. We're done. It's all done. Everyone will love it and we can move on.
So speaking of that, do you do more sort of top-down design or bottom-up A-B testing for this stuff?
Oh, yeah. I can talk a little bit about the research that we did.
Okay.
You know, a lot of design is when we explore ideas and we come up with an approach that we think is going to work, you know, it's sort of like a hypothesis, right? Yeah. And then we take it into user testing to see if our hypothesis is correct. And we have some burning questions we want to answer, like, is this the right label? Do people understand what these icons mean? Things like that. In the case of volume and Do Not Disturb, actually Do Not Disturb specifically, we had two hypotheses amongst the team that we thought were equally, they could equally work, but we wanted to know what users thought of them. So what we did was we built some really high functional prototypes. We have prototypers who work directly in our design group. And they built these prototypes that we could give to users out in the field and they could live with it for a couple of weeks. If we brought them in the lab and just spent like a half hour saying, hey, what do you think, you know, watching them and getting their impressions, it just gives us a limited view. But by doing these more longitudinal studies with real prototypes, we got to see how people lived with it. And we got some much better, much richer information and insights from
users. So when you're saying real prototype, does that mean that it was actually implemented in system UI?
Yes.
Some sort of, okay. So
we had to do a special build.
Okay.
And then we had to put it on devices and give it to people.
I see.
But yes.
So it's a special kind of, because usually when I think of visual design and prototypes, it's like it's built in, well, it used to be Flash or whatever.
Yeah,
or,
it's like a demo.
Exactly.
Yeah. No.
You know, the buttons just basically take you to the next state. It's not actually
right.
doing anything.
But no, this sounds like it was a prototype. This was the real, the real
prototype
deal.
In a sense that it was in production code maybe, but.
Yeah, okay. It was almost production code. In fact, I think the team was able to use some of it for production code.
And then did you record lots of analytics about what people were doing, or was it more based on an interview afterwards to sort of see
swear
what they felt?
Swear words per minute per user. Yes. Yeah.
There was, we collected people's perceptions and experiences with it throughout, more qualitative than quantitative.
Does that volume make you feel?
It was more like, did you have any... Tell us about, you know, any frustrating moments you had where you expected some, you expected Do Not Disturb to work in a certain way and it didn't do what you expected. Things like that. But even before we got to that big prototype stage, we did do earlier testing with in the lab with very lightweight click-through prototypes.
Yeah, because it seems like an investment to build these prototypes.
Absolutely. That was an investment. We had already done a few rounds of lab studies before we got to the point where we did the longitudinal studies.
Interesting.
So other stuff? I mean, volume was fairly huge, especially since, you know, there was stuff in the lollipop that needed to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Other stuff that you've worked on?
Oh, yeah.
System UI?
For many years, I worked on settings for Android. Yeah.
Did you come up with the seven tap thing? That's my favorite thing.
I did not. I don't know
Easter
who did
egg
that.
Of developer.
Yeah. Office. Yeah.
I think when that was being launched, wasn't the whole way we sold it? We'll have an app in the store too, so you can actually go and do this. But I don't think we ever pulled the trigger on that. So I guess we like it. Like, hey, we don't really want you to write apps if you can't find this.
It's kind of fun. You're in the club.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like this bar. Like, look, if you can't figure this out, you're going to have a really hard time when you start Android Studio.
Yes. Yeah. So I started working on it in Ice Cream Sandwich, and when I came in to that, the challenge there was there are all these different pieces. You know, settings is huge. There are hundreds of screens, and they're worked on by different teams because a lot of features in the Android system have a settings component to it. So it all comes together. So for that, a big part of my job is what we call information architecture, figuring out the right way to organize all of these things in a way that people could understand, you know, get to things quickly. Back then, we didn't have a search functionality, so it really was all browse. So we had to create a good table of contents to all of the settings.
And did that also bleed into quick settings, or that was just a totally different thing?
So I've also worked on quick settings, and I worked on the redesign of quick settings in, I guess it was Lollipop. Yeah. So with that, that's also an interesting challenge because one of the things that I needed to do and articulate for our organization was, what is the difference between what goes in quick settings and what goes in settings? We decided early on that quick settings should be a subset of settings. So anything we had in quick settings, we should also have in settings. But we needed to come up with some good criteria for what is worth being in quick settings, because we didn't want everything.
What are the seven most important things?
That's right. Yeah. So it was things that you need to use frequently without leaving your current context. That's one of the lovely things about quick settings is you can pull it down while you're in the middle of an app, touch something, and then, you know, swipe it back up, and then you're back where you were. Whereas if you're going to the full settings, you have to jump into that app.
Right, plus you know how you can get to it very quickly. So I think I use the hotspot one all the time now.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not on the phone, I just pull the phone out of my pocket, turn on hotspot so that I can use my laptop.
Yep.
And yeah. Airplane mode is good, and I'd like to argue for profile GPU to be in there as well, so we could take that under consideration.
Yeah, I'll note that.
Yeah. Okay. You must get a lot of requests from engineers where they're like, this would make a lot of sense. You should do this thing, and you're like, thank you. Yeah. Just the fact that you suggested that means that it's a low priority.
Oh.
But I mean, it is very tough, especially at a place like this or any engineering-driven culture where we are, you know, writing the product. We're also using the product on an everyday basis. We have strong opinions about how things should work, but we are clearly not the target demographic for the end product. Like, yeah, we're writing APIs. We're trying to make things easier for developers, but users have to use these things, and they're not necessarily software developers.
Yeah, and so what I try to do when I'm talking to engineers is really, you know, sit with them and help them understand the larger users and, you know, is this something that's going to be critical for them? Yeah, that segues nicely into one of the other interesting challenges for settings is there's this meme that we have in our company, just make it a setting. And we can't have everything be a setting, because if we did, we would have thousands of them and it would get out of control for users. So how do you figure out what should and should not be a setting?
Yeah, good question. And what is the answer to that?
So my take on it was, first of all, is it a setting in the first place? Is it a user preference in the first place? When I first came on board, I saw a lot of non-settings things in settings, like legal information.
That's true. And about box.
Yeah. And I made a rule that, no, settings should be for actual things that are user preferences. And then figuring out if this is something that, like, let's say 99% of the people will always want, like, let's say there could be A or B, but 99% of the people would want A, maybe it doesn't need to be a setting. You know, maybe we should just make it behave A and not worry about making it something customizable. However, if there is a minority of people that want it the other way, and there's like a really, really important reason why it should be that way, then yeah, maybe we should. But we should default to A. Mm-hmm. Should always have good smart defaults. Figure out what do we think most people will want it to be set at? What's the most conservative thing? What's the safest thing? Those all come into play when figuring out a default for setting.
So, different topic. Tor was talking about the tools that you used before. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that might be interesting for people to know is I assume that a lot of people listening are either individual developers or in small developer teams or small mm-hmm. companies where there's not necessarily dedicated design person, much mm-hmm. less group. So what would you suggest? How do they approach some of the stuff that you do, like designing the interaction model? I mean, cutting the assets, they can sort of come up with, you know, the colors and the images that they want, however they mm-hmm. do that. But it's the larger process of designing the application experience or user testing. Like, how do they do this if they're on their own? Are there good resources out there? Are there good tools and approaches?
Yeah. So our Google Design site has material design resources, and there are sections that are specifically about app structure and navigation. You know, there are certain flavors of apps. You know, there's the ones where, you know, there's clearly going to be a top level menu, and then there's going to be children, you know, like a list of something and then a detail page. That's a very common pattern. Or sometimes there's like a very single purpose utility app like a camera, and for that you need to optimize the user experience to make it as easy and quick as possible to take that picture.
Are there some specific anti-patterns or things that you've seen that you'd like to let developers know to avoid? So we just heard about don't put legal information in as a setting.
Yeah.
Preference. Anything else that you can think of that you sort of think that if you see that from a junior, you know, designer mm-hmm. or from a developer, you're like, hey, please change that.
One of my soapbox things has to do with strings, with words. When you have an error message, when something goes wrong, don't blame the user. It's probably not their fault, right? It's probably the fault of the app. Just quickly tell them something went wrong and help them recover as quickly as possible. But
And I think
even if it's something where they could have they didn't enter something correctly, you know, like maybe there is a certain like a username or a password that needs to be entered, but there's some criteria for the number of characters or something. Don't yell at them. Don't tell them they did it wrong. I mean, you probably should have had a hint on that field saying 6 character minimum.
Yeah,
so look for ways to anticipate.
Or if the minimum is like 50 characters and special symbols, then maybe that's unreasonable too.
That's
too.
Pet peeve. Yeah. Maybe the problem is not with the user, but with your password policy.
And I remember we had some resources, at least back in the Holo days, for string specifically. There's a lot of recommendations we have, you know, using either the active or the passive voice. And I can't remember which one is good and which one isn't. And there's a bunch of words we're telling you to avoid. And that's actually a really, really useful thing as well.
And we have that on the Google Design site too.
Okay, perfect.
Yep.
Words like dummy, don't touch that. Yeah. A lot of exclamation points, and all caps are really important too.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm taking notes here. This is good.
Yeah. But just remember, pet peeve of mine, and Lint will warn about this, if, you know, OK should be capitalized, both letters.
Yeah. Another good thing to look at to help guide you, and this was something that I worked on in 2012, it still applies, which is Android's design principles. And how that came about was I worked with the researcher of the group at the time. She had done a big field study and talked to many, many people, went into their homes and watched them as they used mobile products of all kinds, not just Android. And then there was all this information, and a lot of it was just really depressing. It's like there are all these things that are bumming people out, and we didn't want to have to deliver in that way. So what we did was we grouped it into themes, and then we turned it into like actionable catchphrases that people could remember. So things like only interrupt me if it's important, which is great when you're thinking about whether to generate a notification or not. Or do the heavy lifting for me, which would say like, you know.
Robots are for.
I use all these phrases with my children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they work well for relationships too, mm-hmm. a lot of them.
Not on a permanent basis, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, decide for me, but let me have the final say. Yeah, yeah. There's.
I'll let you know how that works out at home.
Yes.
Okay. So I assume, is that on the design side? It's not on the material side. This is pre-material design.
It's pre-material, but I think you can get to it from the material site still.
Okay. Yeah, we'll put a link in the blog.
But, you know, if you are in a small team and you don't have a designer, you can hang up these principles on the wall, and as you're trying to decide how the experience of something should be, you can look through those principles and you can say, like, you know, are we really living up to that one?
Yeah.
And we won't be there to know and judge.
Yeah.
So you can come up with your own answer.
We gave a talk back in 2012 at Google I.O., and I was part of it, Jens Nagel and Nate Strew. And we talked about this a lot, like, what do you do if you're designing an Android app but you don't have a designer? So that talk, I think, is still relevant today. And it talks about, it has a pyramid of things you should think about. So the most important thing, the one at the bottom, the big one, is knowing the app's purpose and structuring it in a way that optimizes for that purpose. And then it goes up from there. And then at the top of the pyramid are like the visual embellishments and the polish.
That sounds like it's a whole talk that answers that one single question.
Yeah, pretty much.
So,
so we're just going to play that talk now. We brought a laptop. Sit back and relax. Okay, Gail, I'll link to that as well. There have been a lot of design talks at the last, 2 to 3 IOs.
Mm-hmm.
Probably worth watching a bunch of those as well, where the designers from the design team or, I don't know, other companies as well, or certainly just more rounded information on designing in general, certainly material design at the last IO.
Yeah, I really had the impression that a lot of it was very visual. So, you know, my impression of the material design is really a lot, mostly about the visual design and animations and everything, but it sounds like it's more to it than that.
Yeah, there is. There is definitely an interaction component as well. But I think most developers out there having more anxiety with the visual and motion part of it because that's a skill set that's so specialized that's really hard to find and also to hire for in a small team. So having patterns and actual code that you can work with there is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just the whole concept of it, you know, the page being a material that interacts and is persistent. I mean, I guess there's a bunch of principles that really imply how your app should work.
Mm-hmm.
Because having magic jump from one screen to the next doesn't really fit with that whole interaction model.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are also tons of resources about that too, about the fundamentals of material design, how you can get in the mindset of thinking about that as you're building an app. And then all the way to the actual, this is how you do this type of motion from this transition to that one.
Were you involved in there was a Google design conference that Nick Butcher was talking about.
Is that the one with the animated logo, the timer and the, I remember Roman Urich built like a watch face that was doing the special.
No, I wasn't there, but yeah, that.
I don't know if that's another resource or if they were going to do that again.
That conference is now, that's a conference that's geared towards designers, so it's by Google designers for designers, the way that Google I.O. is chiefly by and for developers.
Okay. Is there like a coding question to get in the door, and then if you pass it, you're not allowed?
It's a design question. Just like at I.O., you have to pass like a programming test, right? For this, they make you draw something.
Or actually, given the way I see people dress in the design departments in general, you know, here, but also other companies have worked, you could probably just know by the time they get up to the door. You know, the combination of the shirt and the shoes.
Yeah, you're supposed to go to Moscone last month. Sorry.
Yeah. All right. Other stuff? I think we've kind of covered the gamut. I don't know if there was other projects you wanted to call out, but I think we have a good introduction to interaction.
We don't
design.
Really know what we don't know.
Yeah. There's so much to talk about.
Okay,
I could come back some other time.
If someone wants to get, you know, find out more, so other than obviously the very specific Android-specific material design guidelines, are there some books you would recommend, you know, like on this stuff? I think that Don Norman has that book that's famous, right?
But yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to?
Yeah, there's a few good ones. One is called Don't Make Me Think by Steve Krug.
Okay.
And another one is The Inmates Are Running the Asylum by Alan Cooper. Both of these books have been out for a really long time, but they're ones that I read, you know, as I was moving into this field.
Our brains haven't changed that much, right? So book written 20 years ago probably could maybe still apply somewhat to the way we think.
Yeah, what Alan Cooper is trying to do is make the case for this new discipline called interaction designer and explain how it fits into a more traditional software model that people are used to. So it's good for understanding, you know, why we're here and how we can all work together.
How to not make engineering UIs. Yeah, probably a good idea. All right, anything to close with? Say something really smart. Go.
Oh, man.
There, that's good enough.
It works for me.
Great.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.